This is Cave Scott Allen of Otico.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
And this is Rob Connery hijacking your podcast.
I was just going to say, wow.
Sorry.
Hello. Yeah, so it's December 14, 2018. We thought we probably should do at least two podcasts in a year to keep our membership active. How y'all doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Super.
Yay. Kevin. Come on. Kevin.
What's I'm up, here. Kevin? I'm doing well.
Hooray.
I'm still on 2 feet.
Yay. 2 feet is better than three.
Exactly.
So, Rob, you want to write a new ORM?
Yeah, I think it's probably best to start this podcast this way, because we are talking about code. Code is the name of it. You know, I've been sitting here playing with Django because I don't know Python. Right? And I was like, it's time to learn Python. Why not? And so I'm playing with the ORM, and I hate it like most ORMs I hate. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to actually write an ORM that's just like the Ultra ORM, the freak out, ultra crazy ORM. And I'm seriously going to write this where your whole application is one giant query where the code is actually stored in the database. So you just write the SQL for the code, and the code gets pulled in and it gets evaled, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we use some reflection and the Roslyn compiler or whatever to tell me that's not beautiful.
Yeah, well, SQL Server already supports the CLR types, right?
Sure. It's an inversion of inversion of inversion of control.
And I think this is good, too, from the whole thing where people are putting their CSS in their JavaScript. They're putting their JavaScript in their CSS.
Yes.
Put some code in there.
We'll call this isomorphic something or other. I don't know.
So I need some WebAssembly and some blockchain, and I think I can get you some funding.
Actually, you know what would be even better? Okay, so now I'm improving this. So that was my first iteration. The second iteration, we're going to do GraphQL, and the GraphQL is going to be in the database.
So GraphQL is basically OData v4, is that right?
I don't know. Whatever. They have stored routines now, which is great. Stored procedures for GraphQL.
Hmm. Oh, wow.
I think so. At least that's what I read.
The future is very bright.
Did you guys have an agenda? Because I'm just going to destroy it.
Well, it's been a while since we talked. I thought we would talk about what we've been up to, but, you know. Yeah, go ahead and take us out. Well, first of all, Rob, this is crazy. You're working at Microsoft and doing Postgres-y things. Is that accurate?
Yes, and you're going to love this. One of my first tasks was to rev Northwind. Oh, no, seriously, I sat down on day one. So when you start at Microsoft, you go through this thing called New Employee Orientation, NEO. And it's really neat what they do. They sit you down in this big room with all the other new hires. And this is a huge company, right? And I think in my class, there was 500, 600 people? Like, that's how many people start at this company every day. And they put on this big multimedia presentation with speakers, and they get you all revved up and ready to go. They give you a cool backpack. So when you get out, your boss or whoever is supposed to meet you. And so I had, you know, the team come down. They're like, hey, give me high fives, whatever. So we go sit down in the office, and we instantly start talking work. And within 5 minutes, Northwind was dropped. I'm like, what? So Microsoft now has this new offering called Tailwind, which is kind of Northwind grown up. In fact, Tailwind acquired Northwind. That's the story. And so, yeah, we had to write a press release. We had to write a press release. I got to write the press release for it.
Now, are they all part of Contoso Global?
We didn't quite work the Contoso angle in.
And how does AdventureWorks fit into all this?
It's really fun, though, because if you watched the Connect demos and a few others, they all use the Tailwind stuff. That was marketing's stuff that they did, their branding and all that. So it was pretty cool. I enjoyed it. That's what I'm doing.
So, and then one other big question. Was this really just an acqui-hire for Nancy DeVolio?
Yes. Yes. I got to reference Nancy in her press press release.
Oh, good. Wow, that's exciting. Well, so so this is it. Multi database then focus? Or you?
Well, I've got So right now, I've got a Postgres implementation, SQL Server, and I've got some JSON documents that you can load anywhere. So
cool.
Yeah, pretty fun. So actually, that's why I've been building Django. This Django app that I've been doing. My next step here is I want to build out. I don't want to call them reference applications. So my job currently right now, it's funny, I work in developer relations, and people are funny. They're like, I can't believe you're an evangelist. Like, I'm actually not. My job literally is to break things. and I'm so good at that, to break things and cause fights. And so we take Azure stuff, the product.
And you're all out of bubble gum?
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry.
You know, it's, yeah.
Okay, go ahead. I think where we left off was you were causing fights.
No, so I am internal focused, 100% internally focused to product teams and others. And it's great that I don't know anything about Azure because I'm using it from completely layman's perspective. And anyway, it's been pretty fun. That's what I've been doing.
So cool. How is it different from your last time at the mothership?
The last time I worked on a product team, and my job was sort of the same as community PM, but it was kind of the community focus of the product team. And they had the teams that we interfaced with were the evangelists, and they were called evangelists at that time, DPE, platform evangelist. So I kind of straddled the line between the two. But the hard part about being on a product team is that it's most of the team is there at Microsoft. And if you're not there and in the hallways and having conversations, it can be really difficult. Mm-hmm. Unless you're Scott Hanselman, and which is true. I mean, he's amazing at making his voice heard and calling people, I don't have the reach he does, mm-hmm. which was a problem back then, and now it's kind of cool because I'm on a completely distributed team, and so everybody really goes out of the way to make sure that you're included in technology. They use technology to make sure that everybody's voice is heard and so on.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I do feel like, so I'm in DevDiv and I'm on Scott's team, and it's like there is an effort put into making everything like, you know, distributed friendly, but really like that product team thing is a hard one to do remotely. Like people that have been on a product team in Redmond for a while and then moved away have made it work. But if you're just kind of like some remote person, it's just really hard to yeah. in the loop on that stuff.
So. Yep. Yeah. And it's bad because if you try and do something interesting and fun, let's put it that way, you can easily ruffle feathers, for lack of better words, because, you know, there's conversations that are happening that you just don't have access to that you should know about. Mm-hmm. The neat thing about being in my group now is, you know, that kind of thing is embraced because we are literally supposed to break things. And so that's, you know, just to kind of finish what I was saying before, that's why I'm making this Django app, is I'm trying to rev out this Tailwind idea and then Postgres on Azure and break it. See like where the pain points are in terms of deploying Django, Python, right? And we have all these caching backends and everything. Can I deploy this with a shell script? I don't know. Let's find out. And so the cool thing about it is I get to build this and then open source it and people can take it and run with it. And the one thing I made super clear to my boss is I said, I'm not going to just build some crap demo app, right? I'm not going to build something that I want this to be, I don't want to say production ready, but something that I would put in production, you know, if I needed it. And so they said, absolutely. And so it's so fun. So anyway, I'm building this and my next one's going to be on Elixir and my next one after that, GraphQL in the database.
So how's it going so far with the Django and the Python and the Azure? Like, are they playing friendly?
Yeah, pretty much. There's a lot of, it's funny to step into such an old platform and to see the result of all the decisions over the years. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I feel like Node is so wild. Like, it's just, you could do whatever you want, however you want. no one really cares, right? But Django is very opinionated. Same with Rails. And you get to this thing, you're like, why are you doing it this way? And then you realize there's this story, and then there's like this undercurrent, like cult of the Pythonic way. like whatever. But I mean, it's kind of fun to learn. So I'm enjoying it.
Cool.
Yeah. Do you guys, any of you guys do Python at all? Okay, Scott, you do Python. Have you done some Python?
I have a bit, yes. But I never got into any of the web frameworks with Python.
I did a tiny amount with a long time ago. I worked on a search server implementation at a financial company, and all the configuration stuff was in Python. So I had to just hack my way through it, you know? And then more recently, my daughter had a programming class and it was in Python. She's like, "You're a computer programmer, help me out." And I'm like, "Oh crap." You know? so I showed her, you know, how to Stack Overflow and, you know, copy and paste code. And
so Kevin, but you work in Node every day still, right?
Correct. Although just in the last week, I've started to play around with some machine learning stuff, which is a lot of that stuff's done in Python. And I swear to God, every time I try to use Python, it's just like, you know, pip install and then something doesn't compile. Like every time. It's just so, you know, I was trying to install some machine learning library, and it was like 6 hours of crap. How do I fix this compiler error?
Yeah.
So I was at Dev Intersection last week and got to see, I spent a while, I went to a dinner and I was sitting next to John Lamb. And then the next day I went to lunch with him, and then I went and saw his talk. So I got the heavy John Lamb machine learning. So he wrote, he worked on some stuff for the keynote presentation with some machine learning, where it was doing some different things, but one was like classifying dog breeds and stuff. And so it was cool to hear his, you know, to look at what he was doing. And I've, before that, I'd been looking at ML.NET, which is a .NET machine learning library. And he was showing me, you know, stuff with Python. And he's saying, well, you know, like most of the stuff, if you're going to read, like most of the journals, most of the things you're going to see, you know, most of the new stuff getting published is Python, and it's harder to find, you know, a C# implementation. So, and his demo that he was walking through was all in a Jupyter notebook, which is kind of neat. Have you guys played with that? Mm-hmm. It's a markdown document with Python in it. And then you can like, basically there's, you know, like keyboard commands where you can navigate through, or you can, you know, click run, and you basically like any of the markdown, it just, you know, highlights it and you read it, and then you click on the next thing and execute it. And so you're like, it was interesting. So it's basically like a Python file with a bunch of comments written in markdown kind of. So that was cool. I was going through, and he had, there's a whole thing that configures and runs a, the keynote demo that they did, and it was all in a Jupyter notebook. So it was fun.
That's neat.
Yeah, I'd like to look more into, that's one of my, you know, if I get some, if I clear out my email backlog and have some days off this month, I want to mess around with some more machine learning stuff. Because looking at just like what's available and what's possible now, and some of the stuff John was explaining to me is like the advances in how quickly things can be trained. You know, like it used to take so long to train models, like hours, weeks, months, you know, and now stuff can be trained in such short time using GPU resources or using cloud, you know, resources and stuff. It's pretty amazing. I was looking at something yesterday, and it was like a GAN, which is an adversarial model, something, but it was creating faces. Do you guys see this? It's like, it was a YouTube video, and it basically was like they trained it on a bunch of, you know, photos of people, and then it was like just creating photos, that, like headshots of people, and every single one of them looked completely real. Like none of them looked Uncanny Valley, slightly fake at all. And then it was tweaking these parameters, and you're watching people's hair grow out and change from men to women to children and stuff. And every in-between photo of all of them looked natural. It was just like I'm watching on the fly as like millions of human faces are being created by a computer, and every single one of them would fool me. It was, you know, it's just like, dang.
Wow.
Yeah. And John was explaining to me too, some of the stuff with like, you know, originally they were doing the training for like how having a computer beat a human in Go. And then like originally it was like trained with all these rules and stuff. And then the next versions of it they did where they just basically gave it the rule book and had it play itself. And that that new implementation was able to, what was it? Alpha? I forget the name of it now. But the newer one was able to like in something like 24 hours of playing itself in Go was able to beat the Grandmaster. And then they gave it the chess rule book and it's able to play at the same level in chess. And it's like, it's just crazy. Like how far that stuff has come.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a question. I have a question for you guys. And for anybody listening, really, I've been thinking about this nonstop. So as I've been learning Python, you know, it's an old language, as I was mentioning. And I feel like, don't you think that as we move forward and start tackling issues like that, and as our industry is starting to do, I mean, don't you think we need better ways to communicate to a machine? And like, Kevin, I'm so interested in your opinion on this because you do Node every day. Like you said, you do JavaScript every day. And I hate that language. I hate it primarily because it makes me think about things that I don't want to be thinking about when I'm solving problems. And it sets little traps for me that I constantly have to be careful of. And I, you know, I know it's fashionable to beat up on JavaScript, but every language has its warts. And I keep thinking like, God, I mean, don't you just wish like we could evolve into something that would just be like, whoa, and somehow be able to express ideas and things better?
Meanwhile, Alexa can't understand when we say turn on the lights.
Yeah, I know.
But you're right. It's crazy. There's like some stuff where you're like computers can, you know, outperform us and learn so much faster on some problem sets. And then others we're writing in weird languages that are based on things that were invented 50 years ago.
For all of you guys, when's the last time you programmed anything with the notion of parallel execution in mind? You know, Kevin, do you do that at all? Or, I mean, not asynchronous. I'm talking about like things in parallel. Like let's fan out and do these like 10 things at once.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, it depends on what, you know, exactly what you mean by that.
I mean, I guess that's a loaded question, I know, but like, you know, typically when we sit down and you write a routine, like you're thinking about scoping out some application. You're thinking about things that happen, in, you know, sequentially. At least I am. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's just me.
I don't know. Back when I used to use like the async library in JavaScript a lot, it had a lot of constructs for saying, "Okay, I want to do a bunch of asynchronous things. Do them all in parallel, or do them all like, you know, sequence them in this way." And that was a version of what you're talking about, but maybe not exactly what you're talking about, where, you know, the language could handle sort of dispatching and, you know, waiting for things to finish and then, you know, collecting the results.
Mm-hmm. It's one of the reasons I really liked Elixir. It made you think in those terms.
What's the main use case for doing that kind of thing? Like, is it running a bunch of like in the context of an application, like maybe, you know, it's doing multiple searches at once and compiling the best information, or, you know, because I was thinking of this recently with this kind of machine learning thing. It's like, that's all really neat stuff, but what would I actually use it for if I'm not like a data scientist or whatever, you know? So in the context of this kind of parallel execution, are you thinking of this for database queries or?
Well, I remember when I was learning Node years and years ago, and the big pitch was you just do it, you know, asynchronously. Everything's async, 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 right? You got the event loop, blah, blah, blah. And I mean, how many times did you hear people say, like, what the hell do you need to be? What's, you know, computers are really fast. Asynchronous is silliness. And the next thing you know, like a few years later, I mean, of course the utility is there. And so like, you know, what is it? MVC now does everything asynchronously, which is great. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty normal. So like, that's just kind of natural. It's a natural progression to using a computer at its full capacity, or a network of computers at their full capacity, or the cloud, right? You know, pushing something into the cloud to use it at its full capacity. You're not going to build a gigantic app monolith. You're going to make it these little things that like spread out sideways. Mm-hmm. And I really think it's that shift in thinking that is going to push programming forward, but it just doesn't seem very natural. Or maybe, I don't know, maybe am I just stuck in the past? I'm really trying to figure this out.
Well, you know, and then it's okay, so a lot of languages have added, for async, right, they've added in things like async await, and so, but is that like, does that solve the problem, or is it just kind of lipstick on a pig, or what, you know? Like,
I don't know. I mean, it's a good question.
I find async await to be extremely frustrating sometimes.
Mm-hmm. How so?
Do you, like, go ahead, sorry.
I ran into a situation a couple months ago where you get into these situations where maybe you're using an older library or something like that that has an event handler, and you want to write async code, but this event handler is going to return void, and you get into one of these situations where async code meets non-async code, and it's just so difficult. And if you go out and do some Google searches, you'll find 15 articles about what you're really supposed to do and what you're really not supposed to do, and how bad of a programmer you can be if you get yourself into this situation. But to me, it's happened over and over again the last, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. It makes me think sometimes, so maybe the C# language designers didn't quite go far enough to make this as easy and as complete as they should have.
That reminds me of, so I worked on something for, was it .NET Conf? We had, I forget, 100 and something, 150 worldwide events. And the way the source of data for that was there was information that was in SurveyMonkey and was in, then we had to Bing map it. Like it was a bunch of API calls. And so I had originally, I set that up using quartz.net. And so it was like a scheduled task. And then it would, you know, and I hit that whole viral async thing where all of a sudden now the service is async and now everything else that it touched had to be async. And it was a pain in the neck.
Right.
So then I had to do something else recently like that for the .NET Foundation website. And I ended up just creating Azure Functions that created a JSON file. Mm. And I just load it. And so I have like several Azure Functions that just do their thing. And it took all that away, you know, like, so the website is just like, go get this JSON file. It's got everything all figured out for you. Don't even worry about it, you know?
Right.
So you kept the web app much simpler.
I was going to say another example I can think of that's happened within the last 3 or 4 months is something I had to use inside of ASP.NET Core Configure Services that required an async initialization. But Configure mm-hmm. Services, again, returns void. So what do you do? You can go out and you can find 10, 2,500 word articles on what to do and what not to do, but none of them actually come out and answer the question. Yeah. Sometimes it's so frustrating.
And they disagree sometimes too.
And they disagree. Yeah.
Cause it's like, you should never do this. And then you'll find somebody else a year later. Well, actually, you know, right. And then it's like, well, shoot, what is it? yeah, I'm always scared. I'm always certain I'm doing it wrong. Whichever I pick, I'm doing it the wrong way.
Funny. It's one of the reasons I picked Go as a language for a little project I was working on a few months ago. Basically, a quick description of that is I wanted something to replace Azure Policy for a company I'm working with. I don't know if you're familiar with Azure Policy, but Azure Policy in a way should be a very effective tool, because what Azure Policy allows you to do is set up little rules and little checks inside of a subscription or inside of a resource group or inside of Azure to make sure developers are doing the right thing. So if you've ever turned loose a team of like 12 developers inside of Azure or AWS anywhere, you probably know you end up with people using all sorts of different naming conventions and not configuring things with encryption at rest. And you just want to have something that'll do all these audit checks for you. So one of the things Azure Policy can do is you can set it up to say, go out and make sure all of my SQL databases are encrypted at rest and have require encrypted network connections and so forth. And you can set up rules about naming conventions and rules about where things should be located is another important one sometimes. You know, we have to have things on the East Coast or we have to have things in Europe and so forth. But Azure Policy in a way is just didn't feel right to me. It was difficult to work with. You express the rules in JSON, which isn't a programming language. So it kind of felt like back in the day when XML was very popular and people started doing imperative programming with XML constructs, and it just turned my stomach. And then some things make me think that the people who implemented Azure Policy never used it at all. So they have a built-in policy check to make sure databases are encrypted, except that policy check will try to force the master database on a SQL server to be encrypted, and you can't encrypt the master database, so the policy fails everywhere. Anyway, try to make a longer story short, I decided to write my own, I wanted to write my own little rules engine by calling into the Azure SDK, and I decided to use the Go language because I think going back to something Rob said earlier, I tend to think of not being parallel from the start. I tend to think of I'm going to do step A, B, C, and top-down decomposition, whatever you call it. But I knew at some point in the future, this tool would be making so many HTTP calls to the server to check this resource and that resource and this rule that there'd have to be an easy way to make that run, some of those operations run in parallel. And to me, Go looked like a pretty good language to do that with its Go routines. And it turns out it is an interesting language for concurrency.
I have to say on the JavaScript side, one thing that I always felt about async await is that it's so easy that it almost pushes you to write linear code where if we didn't have async await, you wouldn't necessarily, you know what I mean? It's just so mm-hmm. easy to do step A and then step B and then step C using async await that even though there are all these other ways to do it where you can make things parallel and concurrent and they're, you know, it's just not quite as easy. And so it's very easy to slip into the trap of serializing things that don't need to be serialized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is very like you said, it's very serial and it's not parallel friendly. Like what if there was an async await that was more parallelizable, whatever. Like
it's something to think about too, I guess, at least for me, since I brought it up, is you know, a lot of people out there might be saying, don't rely on your programming language and runtime to do this for you. You know, just use something like RabbitMQ. Yay. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. We? I'm sorry.
Yeah, we use Rabbit.
Have you guys ever used Rabbit?
No.
Yeah, it's been great.
And has it worked okay for you? It is weird. I talk to people that say either that or they say, oh my God, we got rid of it as fast as we could. Yeah, so... It doesn't. What was one of the issues that someone brought up? Corruption or disk failure, something like that. I mean, how do you guys? Because I mean, it's your same point of failure. Right?
I mean, it does. It does do. You know, does have clustering kind of options, although we haven't configured that. But yes, it is. It does represent that. However, it is. It has for us been an extremely reliable piece of software. The only issues we ever have with it has been when we let the server run out of disk space. Which, you know, if you're when you're pumping millions of messages through, you know, can happen. But aside from that, like, we haven't had even one problem with it.
You know, Kevin, if you unit tested, you could probably catch that error.
Yeah, well, that's a thing, right? How do, I mean, once you get these, like one nice thing about monoliths is they are relatively easy to reason about and test and stuff. But when you get these distributed systems and async and then messaging and all that, it's pretty hard to do that, right? I mean, I guess you can test each system in isolation, but then the like compound effects of one thing, you know, cascading error handling and stuff. There was a really interesting talk that I saw Jimmy Bogard do at least once, which was talking about, I believe it was at Dell, and they had this thing with multiple, you know, it was all these, it was distributed. It's like super distributed system. And then one call was like a, you know, like explosion of, you know, like each hit to the website was an explosion of calls because each service called other services and stuff. And it was just like, it went insane. And that again, it's like, well, if one service is slightly slower, then that impacts everything else.
I mean, our application is a microservice architecture, but that is something that we try to design to not have these sort of long chains of services, calling services, partly for that reason. You can't always avoid it, but it is my general preference to avoid that when we can.
Yeah. Yeah. That was in my very simple case, that was really nice to just hide it all in a function and like not worry about, you know, like there's never going to be an API wait in the application itself, right? Because the service itself can, if it takes 5 minutes to run, I don't care. Like I'll, you know, but of course then you're not getting right. the most recent data.
I was just saying, and that's where, using messaging through Rabbit has advantages, right? Where if the service starts to get behind, I mean, assuming you've designed your services to work this way, the service gets a little bit behind, that's okay. It'll just catch up when it can. Now, that doesn't necessarily work if, you know, something's like the UI is waiting on something to happen, but, you know, it definitely does provide that a little bit of that insulation that, you know, makes it so the services, if the service gets overwhelmed, it can catch up eventually.
Okay. So my latest, like whenever I hear MQ, like I go way back to MSMQ. Is it at all related? Is it similar? I mean, because I remember all of the, you know, your messaging and you have your distributed, like you have to check your dead messages. Yeah, I mean,
it's similar. A lot nicer. a lot, you know, faster. Sure. And like, I just remember MSMQ being a dog. But it's definitely, you know, affects how you design your services. And, you know, we try to construct our stuff around sort of business events, and business events have being able to, you know, having services being able to react to business events autonomously. So that helps kind of, you know, break the chains of services or calling services. You get something happened, and everybody who cares about that thing happening can do something in their own little service world.
Do you have problems with services or with those events, like the ordering of those events? You know what I mean? Like it would seem like some things could be a problem where if I get a debit before I get the deposit or whatever it is.
It hasn't been a big problem for us, but there are one or two places where we've had to deal with, you know, we kind of expected this service to get the event before this service and that didn't happen. Or this service had some big backlog in its queue, and so it processed the message much later than this service and that caused an issue. But it hasn't been a big problem.
So I'm curious. When I was looking into RabbitMQ years ago, I forgot why, but I remember trying to evaluate that with ZeroMQ, and I'm sure you get these questions a lot when you start talking about Rabbit. But I know that one has like a centralized kind of app service base. That's Rabbit, right? And ZeroMQ is network based and protocol based, which I thought was fascinating.
I have not.
Have you ever have you used Zero much or? No, just curious if you guys did any kind of compare and contrast, just because. I mean, you know, as developers, we can't resist the urge of asking, have you tried? But I'm only asking this because I want to know.
ZeroMQ doesn't provide persistence, right?
I think that was
one reason why we didn't.
I don't know.
But, I mean, this was all like 2 years ago, so I don't remember exactly. But, you know, we wanted to be able to persistently store messages in case something happened.
I guess that makes sense, yeah.
And then is this like event source style?
No, we don't do
it. Or not quite
that? We don't do event sourcing, no.
Like, do you replay?
I never caught into that that model. We discussed a little bit, but it didn't seem to be a big win for us. So,
So we've ran that one out. Do we get to talk about blockchain?
Blockchain.
How's everybody's Bitcoin values these days?
I have two funny things to say about blockchain and Bitcoin. One, I'm writing the second volume of Imposter's Handbook currently, and I have a whole chapter on blockchain and cryptocurrencies and whatever. And so I had, at the time, someone write me an email who bought the book and said, because it's on pre-order anyway, they bought it and they said, I can't believe you're writing about this, and you don't have a link to your wallet or whatever. Yeah, well, I suppose I should. And so the guy was really nice. He walked me through setting up a wallet, which I had done once, but
and how
lost.
Many millions of dollars is that worth right now?
Right,
I'd lost. No,
you know, it's funny. This was 6 years ago, 7 years ago, maybe. I don't know. It's a while ago, and it's probably worth a little bit of cash. But anyway, so this guy sends me money, and using Bitcash, that's what it was. And so you put it on my phone. I'm like, all right, cool, this is neat, you know. And then I upgraded my phone and lost my wallet. It's probably out there somewhere. But so there's that. And the second part was, I was going to tell you, I got to write a blockchain scratch or by hand using Ruby. Thank you very much. Exactly.
When's the ICO?
I just, you know, I'm so tired of everyone saying it's just a linked list, you know, because obviously it's got to be more than that. But it was kind of fun to dive in and I mean, obviously without the networking consensus stuff, but just to write the basics of it, I enjoyed it. Mm.
I had a similar thing where I realized that I had a wallet that was on an old hard drive, and like over a year ago or so when prices were going up, I dug out the hard drive, and then I ended up putting it on one of them like Coinbase or something like that. And I'm like, I honestly don't care if it gets hacked. I don't have, you know, it's a few hundred dollars maybe, but then it went way up and then it started going down, and I guess it's very low now.
I mean, it's pretty profound, I have to say, to have like the way this guy who set me up, the way he put it, he's like, the ability to programmatically send someone money is huge. And of course in my head I'm like, well, you can do that with Stripe, have you tried? You know, but to not involve a bank, you know, is fascinating to me. You know, like, no bank has touched us, no organization, no government has touched us. I can totally see why people have such a strong feeling for this. You mean, but obviously there's a ton of downside to it. I mean, we all know that. But still, it's pretty neat to see that money on your phone or on your computer and think, wow, you know, I can just send this to somebody else and nobody else can get in the way. It's kind of neat. I don't know.
Yeah.
Am I alone? Yeah, I think I'm alone here.
No, I think it's neat. It's just a hard thing. It's not pegged to anything. Which is, you know, good and bad. Like, because there were previous cash things that were linked to gold, right? I don't know, e-gold or something. And then those things always, too, there's like really positive things, and then they also attract anybody that wants untraceable transactions, which is...
Well, it's, you know, it's a fascinating, when you get into the politics of it all, like the fiat currencies, what you're talking about, you know, where it's but our currency is not based on that anymore. Our currency is based on what the government says it is. Yeah. And that's nuts. And like, you know, so we have been printing money since 2008 or 7, or maybe before that, literally printing money and flooding our economy to keep us out of devastation, you know, and whoa. And you think about that and you think about what it could mean for you personally, and not to get too political, and you know, everybody's got their opinions about stuff, but still, when you look at just in terms of supply and demand and economics, like the more currency that's out there, the more money that's out there, the higher the prices are going to go, and you're totally going to start messing with people's ability to maintain a living. And that's all based by one or two people's ideas of what to do in the government. And that's kind of crazy. And then again, you can see the appeal to crypto, which is controlled by no one, but then you have to deal with the gyrations.
Sorry. Well, no, that, but what's also interesting there, so there's the currency side to it, but there's also just the, like the information verification and like the, you know, information can be stored in blockchain. Cause I've also talked to people that are looking at blockchain for other things that are not, you know, currency related at all, right? You can have verifiable.
Okay, so let me ask the dumb question.
So that's kind of wild. It's,
like, is anybody actually doing anything useful with that fact? Like, you hear, like, oh, we're going to blockchain this, or we're going to blockchain property records, or we're going to block. But, like, is this just all, is it all just BS? I mean, I honestly don't know sometimes.
Well, you know, Azure has a blockchain workbench.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. I'm going to make sure my boss listens to this. Now, it's out there. You know, it's a good question. Has anybody done anything? I was talking to Hanselman, Scott Hanselman, about this because he's actually helping me write this book. So we've been going back and forth about this kind of stuff. And everyone's got strong opinions about it. But he said, if it was something, don't you think it would be something? And I'm trying to remember another comment came along. I'm trying to remember who it was, but you know, one of these big web guys, big thinkers, basically said, you know, all great technology changes came in through the back door because a programmer is trying to get something done. That's not so with blockchain. And I saw what he was saying, but that's taking a technical perspective look at it. When you think of it in terms of political perspective, there's every reason in the world to have something like this, especially for economies like the Russian and African and whatever that are upside down, Venezuela specifically, right? So in that sense, it's wonderful. Now, back to the blockchain question that you asked, Kevin. It's so hard because what are you going to, like, where are you going to stick it that is ever going to gain traction that has anything, you know, there's startups out there that are trying to do this. I know that SAP has basically jumped right into it because they know that it could upend completely their entire business proposition, storing sensitive information, right? But of course, you know, I know people out there right now are probably screaming at their you know, iPods or whatever, listening to, like, shut up with blockchain. But the idea behind it is actually really good in terms of storing sensitive information. But yeah, no one that I know of has ever done anything with it.
So, I mean, I'm looking on Wikipedia and they have things like, yeah, like smart contracts, banks, you know, like the verifiable, like proof of existence kind of stuff. Like you said, anybody whose business could be disrupted by blockchain has a reason to be involved. There's also issues with, like, the more that the blockchain grows, then you run into, like, it taking exponentially longer to verify things, I think. and then there's also issues where people have put, like, copyrighted or, like, you know, gosh, like child pornography or stuff into blockchain just to screw with people. So, like, that's also bad too.
You can store anything in there.
Yeah. So then that's positive and negative, right? So that's also something where it's like, you know, how do you, it does seem like it could be useful. And like you said, this distributed sort of thing, it feels, you know, like some technologies are driven by one bubble that doesn't end up being where the real value is, you know, like, and so it's possible, like, the cryptocurrency thing is useful and drives, you know, some of the technology, but then the actual, like, killer app is something else.
cryptocurrency, like, is Bitcoin really useful as a currency anymore? Like, it's this weird thing that has these huge value fluctuations. It's not really a stable store of value. Like, would you buy a pizza with Bitcoin in this day and age? Like, yeah, I know. I love that Twitter feed of the guy who's, you know, whose pizzas are now worth $15 million. But like, so what, yeah. What is it good for?
Well, so, I mean, the bigger issue, we're glossing over that really shouldn't be glossed over is that right now the Bitcoin network is gigantic. I'm actually sitting here looking at these facts and figures, this research I put together for the thing I wrote. But anyway, to mine a single Bitcoin, and I want to make sure I got this number correct. To mine a single Bitcoin.
Yeah, that's the whole other thing with Bitcoin.
It takes 300 kilowatt hours of
energy. Just the environmental impact of the friggin' thing.
Yeah, that's okay. And so I'm trying to look at this. 900 kilowatt hours is what it takes to power your house for a month. So like they're saying that it's going to exceed a single Bitcoin mine. It's going to exceed 900 kilowatt hours by the end of this year.
It's ridiculous.
So right. So that right there is just like disqualified the whole idea, you know? Yeah. And it's funny. I was talking to Scott, again, Hanselman, about this because he was saying that he downloaded some app that will sit on your video card and mine Bitcoin with your video card while you're not at home. And I think he said he made $100 or something like that doing it. But yeah, his electricity bill was, I think, $300. Mm-hmm.
Well, and the time when you could do that has kind of passed by now, right? Everything's moved to like specialized hardware and ASICs and stuff.
Yeah, and there's more Bitcoins flooding the market.
I don't know. I wonder whether blockchain will just end up on the dustbin of history as an interesting science project that didn't really go anywhere.
Well, so I part of the research into this thing is like, what are people trying to do to mitigate this? And they're trying to come up with faster network protocols. They're trying to come up with algorithms for better mining, although they can't do that too much or else it defeats the purpose. I know they're trying to do a bunch of stuff, but yeah, I don't know. It kind of seems like a dead end.
Let's not end the year on that.
Is that kind of a dead end? Yeah, in the end, yeah, here we are.
Well, I mean, if it wasn't for the environmental impact and the huge power, like, inefficiency, there are some interesting things that we talked about, but with all of them, there's these huge Achilles heel things, too, where it's like, well, there's all these positive things of distributed money, but you can't rely on it. Or there's, you know, positive things with, you know, storing transactions, but then it's also, like, inefficient in some ways, and I don't know. And we haven't seen anyone like really do anything useful with it. And it's yeah.
Well, I have another sabotage question that I can ask everybody.
Do it.
What is the neatest thing you've learned this year? John, you go first.
And John draws a total blank.
I haven't learned anything, sir.
Yeah. Pass for now?
All right. Does anybody have anything? I can go first if no one has anything. All right. Well, I learned about Claude Shannon. I don't know if I talked about Claude Shannon with you guys on this podcast before, but I have a new cause in life, I think, which is that everybody should learn about Claude Shannon. and specifically, there's two things that I really thought was neat. And it was all just doing research for this book. But I learned how he took these massive room-sized mechanical computers and made them digital. And I don't know if you guys know this, but back in the 1940s, when computers, like, you know, even Turing's computer that they used at Bletchley, it was mechanical. So if you look at the, if you watch that movie, The Imitation Game, you can see these things going clickety, 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 clickety. And so they're literally mechanically trying to figure things out. And so Shannon realized one day, as he was looking at this, he said, oh my gosh, this relates to George Boole's work. And he had taken this mathematics class just on a whim. I think it was like a graduate level class. It was like an elective. And he's like, oh, I'll learn about Boolean algebra. And he thought it was fascinating, true, false stuff, right? So he looked at these switches and these things, and he's like, this is George Boole's idea of ORs and XORs, and you know, we could make this circuit out of true false equations and yes and no switches. And so he did. He just sat down and built it himself. And then he wrote a paper about it when he was in 20 something that basically revolutionized everything and obsoleted all those computers within 10 years time.
Wow.
And no one really, and people usually give over, like when they think about digital computers and the advent of it, they're like, oh, it's von Neumann's machine, right? Yeah, it started with started with Claude Shannon. And then he went in to talk about, like, that wasn't even his biggest thing. Years later, he went into information theory and basically how to send things over a digital network losslessly. And he basically invented computer networking that we know of today. Hmm. Yeah, amazing man. Anyway, there's a book. If anybody wants to read, I read the book. It was amazing. It's called A Mind at Play. Absolutely fascinating man that no one knows anything about. And they call him the Einstein of our age, which is, pretty cool.
I wonder if, so there's a book called The Information. James Gleick wrote it. And I wonder if he's covered in there, because he covered a lot of stuff going from, like, you know, building up to information theory. I really like his stuff in general. I just read a book called Time Travel, where he goes through, and it's like a survey of just thinking about time and time travel through the ages and stuff. And, you know, talking about, stuff going back from, like, the Time Machine and, you know, then up through Interstellar and, you know, modern stuff, and talking. And it's interesting looking at, you know, old ancient societies and stuff, and that they really didn't even think of time in the same way. Before the book, The Time Machine, like, just even some of those thoughts of, like, traveling through time didn't even make any sense. And now it's, like, part of, you know, so many books and movies and stories and things. Completely not related to anything you were just talking about, but I really like his a long time ago, I read a book from him, the Curve of Binding Energy, and it was about nuclear power and nuclear bombs and all that kind of stuff. Again, like a survey kind of thing, but pretty neat. I thought of what I learned this year.
Okay, what?
Well, and I'm hesitate. I big air quotes around the word learned, but I've learned some Mandarin. Wow. I've been doing Duolingo this year, and like pretty, and then also an app called Hello Chinese. And I've toyed with learning several different languages, and I always get blown out when things, I can't keep up with all the, like, genders and tenses and all that kind of stuff. And what I love with Mandarin is there's none of that. It's things are very logically constructed. So you just say, like, the words are a lot more like Legos, and they just snap together. So you don't have to conjugate verbs. You don't need to worry about articles. You don't need to worry about genders. And it's just like, if something means something, it always means that. So, like, there's a question particle. It's basically a question mark. So you can always throw, basically, you can always throw that, like, it always means the same thing. It's not like things change based on other things. Even things like dates, to say, you basically say 2018 year, 12 month, 14 day. Like, that's how you would say that. And so you can, things are really logical. Now, hard. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I'm no language expert, but that didn't sound like Mandarin to me.
Well, yeah. Come on. The problem, let me tell you the problems with it. Hard to write the symbols. So I basically, like, I know enough to kind of recognize them on Duolingo. and I'm not ever going to try speaking it in public. I thought I'd learned a good amount, and I was showing my dad something, and I was like, oh yeah, you can say, you know, like, I don't like panda bears or whatever it was. And I, showed him with Google Translate, and it translated it to one of the most filthy things I have ever seen in writing. It actually said your father, and it was like this horrible insult. And I was just like, oh my God, so sorry. I didn't, you know. So I, the pronunciation is difficult. So I can listen and understand the Duolingo owl, but I'm not going to try and speak it ever.
Are you sure? All right. Well, it's funny, the only Mandarin I know, and I'm going to say it totally wrong, so my apologies, but it goes something like, ma, 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 ma. And I think it means something like mother washes the horse.
Yeah, that sounds, because mama is mother, and then ma, it would be the question mark at the end. So I would probably be something like, but then again, it's the accents are important.
Well, yeah, it's a tonal, like what they call, yeah, tonal language. And I know I murdered the tones, and my apologies. I actually really do not mean to make fun. I just thought it was such an interesting contrast to English, you know, where the tone is so important to differentiate the words.
So one thing that I'm calling a success for me is I saw the movie Crazy Rich Asians, and there was a song, and it was like, it was Wayo Ni Da Ai. And I'm sitting with my wife. I'm like, this says, I have your love. Like that's, you know, it's wa is I, and yao is have. And then ni da ai, ni is you. De is like possession, and then I is love. And I was like, that's awesome. Like, you know, and occasionally like I'll see something, like I'll see some characters and I'll be like, that's a noodle shop or, you know, whatever. So yeah. So, and then it makes you think too about like how you construct things. And I saw a video on this recently where, you know, they're talking about how different languages have different concepts, you know, and it subtly affects your thinking. Like you think in a language. And so, you know, even with things like possession or fault or, you know, like different, and you wouldn't, like some languages, it just wouldn't make any sense to say, I hurt myself, because that would imply like intention. Whereas like, you know, and so it's just, it's really kind of interesting, the subtle things of how language affects your thought. And then there you go, going all the way around to languages.
Rob thinks in ORM. That's his language.
All right, Casey. That's right. Come on, Casey Scott. You think of something yet?
I'm trying to remember what the question was. Something we learned this year?
Oh, yeah. Something interesting and fun that you learned this year.
I can tell you the last interesting book I read was The Rise and Fall of Anheuser-Busch.
Wow. Sounds like a good one.
Never knew much about the Busch family, which would be the beer family, not the presidential family.
So but, they fell?
Quite an interesting and colorful family. Yeah, they felt pretty bad. They had a lot going for them, but basically had to sell everything to other conglomerate.
Is it InBev that owns them now?
Right.
Yeah, that was a big deal. Wasn't it that they were trying to buy all of like the microbreweries, or like, didn't they overextend themselves or something like that? I remember something about this story.
Yeah, I don't remember the financial specifics of how it all started to fall apart, but I can tell you that some of the funniest parts of the book were, you know, here's this Busch family that for generations has been accumulating wealth, and, you know, I think that wealth effect just means your kids are a little bit crazier than you are, and so after four generations, man, you have this youngest Busch who's just batshit crazy. I mean, guns stockpiled in the bedroom, kind of crazy. So that was very, it was an interesting read.
Yeah.
More than I expected.
Yeah, you know, it's on the one hand, when you first say that, it's like, how do you lose money selling beer? Like, I mean, when you've already got, you know, like name recognition and shipping and all that stuff, mm-hmm. but then at those higher levels, you've got the two problems. One is it's more about the finance and all these other kind of abstract things and not actually about the selling at this, you know, at the huge corporation level. And then also, like you said, the generational insanity problems.
But yeah,
because I'm thinking of too, like there's other things where you're like, wow, how do you mess up, you know, different casinos, or how do you mess up a, you know, I don't know. And then it usually does turn into these things of like leveraged buyouts that go wrong or something.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That was a good read.
Oh, God. I don't know.
All right,
know.
Kevin.
I learned to make a pretty darn good latte this year. That,
well, that's interesting.
Actually, mostly
the beans or the machine, or what?
It took me a long time to figure out how to froth milk properly.
I need help with that.
See,
I'm horrible.
Okay, so you need to go to one of the NDCs this year, because Rob Ashton's always there making coffee, and he showed me how to properly do all this stuff. So we have to make sure that he has a sip of your coffee, and then you have to be prepared.
I actually, yeah, we have an episode we recorded a show with Rob, talking about coffee and stuff. It's fascinating.
Cool.
Yeah, actually, that was based on at NDC London a couple of years ago. Rob, you and I were talking to Rob Ashton at that pub, and you guys were going on and on geeking out about coffee. I'm like, oh, I got to record something with him. So the next NDC I was at with Rob, I recorded, because he was talking about stuff like, you know, well, conventional wisdom is you should never freeze the beans because of this and that. But actually, if you know, under these conditions, it's actually the best thing to do, because I can have more of laboratory conditions, and I know the exact brittleness, and I'm not compensating for temperature when I'm grinding. I always know it's the exact same. And, you know, if you vacuum seal them first and all that. So it's fascinating.
Well, that's neat. I, last year, my wife got me an espresso machine for Christmas, and I just started obsessing on all this stuff. It's one of those things where it foams the milk for you, but that
a little bit, I can do
a little bit of art, but I'm not. Did you get into that too?
But that's all tied into like foaming the milk, right? Like if you don't foam the milk, right, then you can't do the art.
Yeah. It's gotta be cold, you know? And then like you're supposed to pound it too much and swirl things around. Yeah. It's like, come on.
I just stick to espresso. I got a lever machine and I just guzzle espresso.
I sadly just broke my frickin' machine. This screw got sheared off and it got stuck inside and I couldn't get it out. And now it's toast. It's done.
I seem to have broken mine somehow. Well, I set it. So I've got two daughters in high school now, and so they're drinking coffee in the morning, and they're up early. So I got one of those, I got a timer that hooks in with Alexa and stuff, and put it on a schedule, because the boiler takes a while to heat up. So I've got it turning on every morning at 5:50, and then they make their coffee, and then I make mine, and then it shuts off at 10 a.m., which is great if you make sure every night before you go to bed that the water boiler is full of water. And so.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, so it ran with like no water in there, burnt, and then like stopped working. So then I'm like, okay, I think I remember something about this, and there was a thermo sensor thing, and I opened the machine up, reset the thermo sensor, and I'm like, and it turns on. I'm like, yes, I'm a you know, technical wizard. And then I'm realizing now that it had also screwed up the thermostat, and I need to take it somewhere.
Oh no. Yeah.
So you know, I've been running on the AeroPress lately.
I have this espresso machine, the Gaja.
Jeez.
And one thing that I think is interesting is like they basically been selling this exact same machine for the last 30 years. Like, there's no great technical innovation, you know, in this stuff. Yeah. It's just the same.
Nope. There's two kinds of things. There's the like machine that's basically been the same for like there's the lever machine and the super simple ones. And then there's the like all in one machine that grinds and brews and does everything. And I used to have one of those, but then if it breaks, you're just screwed. Like it's like back when they made the combination TV VCR.
Right. Thing, I used to know? Have a Super Auto.
It's like, well, I didn't if anything really like breaks, it. The whole thing's broken.
But I used it to make just coffee and not like, you know, espresso really. I don't think it really rates mm-hmm. as a espresso machine. I mean, I think like a real espresso aficionado would sort of turn their nose up at it a little bit. But I did love the convenience of it for sure. Just push a button, fresh cup of coffee.
Yeah. Well,
there's one.
Well, we're at an hour, a little over an hour. So we probably should move towards the wrapping up time.
All right.
So
is there a song, like a special wrapping up song?
Well, there's the drum thing. But I feel like, you know, positive, upbeat thing. Does anyone have anything like during holidays or for next year that you're interested in learning or digging into or whatever?
Well, I learned to play drums this
year. Whoa!
Yeah. And it's kind of cool. I have a teacher so I live in Honolulu now, and there's like these buildings at the basement of this building has these two music studios with everything in them. And so I meet him there once a week, and then twice a week I go in there and practice. But anyway, he's super great teacher, and he has you pick a song that you want to learn. And so he'll teach you like a reasonable drum variation, or if it's a simple enough one. So anyway, I learned, what song did I just learn? Two Clash songs, Train in Vain and Clamp Down. And so just this last week, I was super excited. I did that. And so I'm doing Bad Religion this week, and I am so excited about it.
So along a similar theme, I've started working from home full time now. We kind of gave up our office in San Francisco and turned into a totally remote team. Which is great. And one of the things I want to do in the next year is start taking guitar lessons, which is something I've wanted to do forever, but I feel like, you know, working from home full time might give me a little bit of more flexibility around having time for that kind of stuff.
Cool.
Nice. I do want to play with some like machine learning stuff. That's a near term sort of thing I'm interested in doing. Just go through some tutorials or whatever, but like try and make something fun. My youngest daughter has been doing like Arduino stuff. Well, she's been doing JewelBots. And so I'm thinking she comes up with these crazy ideas. Like, I want to build something where you can point it at like something on the ground and it'll tell you what it is in case you dropped it. And maybe it'll help somebody. And so I was like, oh, this is actually something we could like take a webcam and like wire it to
your
something.
Daughter's like
and,
famous,
you know,
man.
So I thought that'd be a fun thing to play with.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. She spoke at the Red Hat conference and the keynote and stuff. She still like does pair programming with Sarah Chips. Like Sarah, I'll walk by. She's kind of taken over our office, our family office, and I'll walk by the office and hear this laughing and stuff. And she's on a call with
when's,
Sarah.
When's she going to land her first
programming stuff?
Seed funding for her startup.
Yeah. I don't know.
That's great.
Okay, Scott didn't say anything yet.
Awkward silence. Does that mean it's the end? Yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't sure how to chime in. I don't know. I'm taking things easy for a bit next year. I have, if anything, just a resolution to spend more time with my two sons. They're 19 and 17 now, so they're like young adults, and they're a lot of fun with their own opinions and things they want to do. So I don't have any conferences lined up or anything for next year, and we'll just see how it goes.
No, that's great. My daughter's 13, and I find myself, because, you know, she's at a difficult age, right? She's trying to find her voice and everything, of course, right? She's very sweet kid, but at the same time, teenagers. And I, you know, sometimes just get so frustrated and grumpy. And I always have to remember that, they're going to be old and gone soon. I mean, gone out the door, right? Like, yeah, it's good for you. Good for you for spending time with your kids. I think that's great.
Yeah, it's crazy. My oldest is a senior in high school, and she's like applying to colleges and all this stuff. And it's like, whoa.
She can buy her own cigarettes now. It's crazy.
Cool. All right. I resolve that we do this again soon. And I think we have a high enough quality that I will do the post-processing and publish it today. One day turn. Less than a 6-month turnaround on this one.
So. Push to production.
We are agile.
Excellent. Okay. I'm going to press the soundboard button, and it's going to play drums. You ready?
Do I have to learn this groove? Yeah.
Oh, wait. No, that's the wrong one.
This is Kevin.
Well.
This is John Galloway.
You all had a good show. Scott
Kuhn. We're starting over.
Way to end the
game. So, you know what? Scott Kuhn actually was the one that figured out what that drum was from. It's Ike Turner, and it's like the Funky Mule. And it's a pretty good drum beat. So. All right. Well, we'll pretend that worked. And oh, come on now. I still have one other thing here, and it is, all right, and with that, I'm going to hit stop recording.